Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. Today we'll be talking about Oregon's forests and the law that governs them, about clear cuts, herbicide application, notification, and who makes sure the law is followed. With us are three foresters from the Oregon Department of Forestry. Neil Bond is Protection Unit Forester for the Astoria District of ODF. Dan Goody is the District Forester. And Keith Baldwin is ODF's Forest Practices Act Field Support Coordinator. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Neil, can you start out by telling us a little about your job?
Sure. Thanks for having us on the show, Roger. As you said, my job is the Protection Unit Forester for the Department of Forestry here in Astoria. And so I'm in charge of the protection from fire. So we respond to all wildland fires within Clatsop County, and it's my job to make sure that they're put out as quickly and as cost-effectively as we can. I have a lot of support with that. We run our seasonal crew. We have six engines that we run as well with that. I'm also responsible for supervising the two stewardship foresters out of the Astoria District there, and they're in charge of making sure the Forest Practices Act is followed.
And Keith, tell us about your position.
All right, thanks to Roger for this opportunity. I work out of Salem. I'm the Forest Practices Field Coordinator. I support the field staff, primarily the stewardship foresters that implement the Forest Practices Act. I provide technical assistance in interpreting the laws and how to apply them.
And Dan, you're in charge of the whole shebang here in the Astoria District, is that right?
Yeah, that's a polite way of putting it. I have oversight of the three operational programs, which Neil manages two of, which is Protection from Fire and Private Forest, which is the Forest Practices Act, but also the State Forest Program, which there's 137,000 acres in this county that we manage for the citizens of Oregon, and the Board of Forestry is the landowner.
Well, let me try to set a little historical perspective here, and feel free to correct me when I'm wrong, but if we look back just over 200 years ago, in the native lands here, there was just this vast complex of rainforest, with all kinds of different flora and fauna and life. After that came white settlers, private ownership, harvests, burns, more harvest. Some lands were abandoned after harvest, and the counties foreclosed. The counties took possession of the lands. Some of those lands were then turned over to the state to manage under this concept of greatest permanent value. In broad terms, can you say what the Forest Practices Act requires and what ODF's role is in enforcing it?
The Forest Practices Act was started back in 1971, and since then there's been a number of modifications to the rules and the statutes. And the statutes and the rules address forest management for the growing and management of forest trees on private lands or non-federal lands. And it's revolved around everything involved with forest management, from harvesting, road building, chemical applications, slash treatment, and land use changes. So those are best management standards, and it's minimum standards for what a landowner or operator can do to achieve their objectives while protecting the environment.
Now, Dan, with the state forests, you can't sell timber for export from the state forests.
That's correct.
Is that the difference, the main difference?
Well, no, it's a little different. Every landowner has their own objectives for your land or for their lands. State forests, we have, through the greatest permanent value rule, it dictates that we should have a forest management plan, which is a public process. And right now we're operating under the 2010 Forest Management Plan, which has a set of broad strategies and goals. Within those goals, we develop implementation plans, which are 10-year plans, and then annual operation plans, which say what we're going to do from year by year. So we not only have to follow the Forest Practices Act, we also have to adhere to that hierarchy of policy that comes all the way down from greatest permanent value rule through the annual operation plans. But those are landowner objectives, the Board of Forestry's objectives for their lands, which might be completely differently than, say, if it was Dan Goody's tree farm and I had my own goals of growing, say, a rotation of trees to pay for my college for my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
So know, that's the difference between, you know, landowner objective versus statute and law as a regulatory authority.
Do I understand correctly that the Oregon Department of Forestry is funded almost exclusively from timber sales?
For state forests, that's true.
For state forests, it's true.
So for Neil's shop and protection, it's 50% general fund and 50% landowner assessment. So when we put together our protection budgets, these are not real numbers, but say it's $1 million a year, half of that would be paid by the landowners, which is collected through the county as a tax, and then pays for half of the operating budget for the year, and the general fund pays for the other half. For private forests, it's a 60-40 split between general fund and harvest tax, which the landowners, when they sell the timber, pay a tax, and that's collected, and then that pays for 40% of the stewardship foresters' work while they're out there on the ground. So all three operational programs are funded at a completely different scheme, which makes for pretty complicated budget processes, and it creates additional vectors of force when it comes to negotiating growth of those programs.
Mm-hmm. Whether we're talking about the private forest or the state forest, is most harvesting in the state done by clear cut? Is that the usual practice?
In western Oregon, I would say so, and part of that is driven by the ecology itself. West side tree species are generally light-driven ecology, meaning they're racing for the roof to see who can get the sunlight first, as opposed to a dry side, over in eastern Oregon, where everything's a water-driven ecology, if you clear-cut some places over there, you'll have a tough time getting trees to grow back because the water won't hold because the roots are gone. Mm-hmm. A ponderosa will spread out and hog the forest floor with its roots, rather than with the crown. On the coast here, the trees will race to the roof and try to get the biggest crown, the shade out of its neighbors, so it can hog the sun. So the harvesting practices emulate, to some degree, the natural disturbance patterns associated with those plant communities.
Is there a difference in what happens afterwards? Is a private landowner obligated to replant? The state replants, I guess, pretty generally. What about on the private land? Is what happens there?
Right. Just to follow up on that other question you had, I would say that sometimes a landowner's objectives will determine if it's a clear cut or a partial cut. And generally, the smaller family landowner will end up doing more of a partial cut just to have a revenue stream.
Mm-hmm.
But they will do clear cuts as well. But
no, very good point.
They're, so reforestation, or the requirement to plant trees after a harvest, is for all landowners who harvest below a certain level of tree stocking. And the compliance for that is really quite high.
When you thin, you don't necessarily spray herbicides afterward. Is that true? Whereas with a clear cut, it's pretty universal that herbicides are applied afterwards.
That's probably a safe response, is herbicide applications are predominantly on clear cuts.
And why is that? Explain, to a non-forester why we do that.
A landowner may choose to use herbicides help manage the weeds or the undesirable vegetation that's out there that's competing with growing trees, and it's just one of many tools. A landowner could choose to do slash piling, burning, grubbing, using hand tools to cut brush or grubbing grass sod. And
but this would be a small landowner, not one of the major timber companies that owns really a good portion of the land here.
That would choose other options?
Wouldn't the large companies be unlikely to choose hand?
In certain sensitive areas, they may choose to use less aerial applications of herbicides.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, they would use the herbicide application on larger clear cuts.
Well, Neil, you and I emailed back and forth a little bit about herbicides and mm-hmm. notification and so on, and I'm glad you're here, because I didn't quite understand how that works. There was a notice in June, I think it was, and there was a little bit of mix-up on dates, so it appeared the notice was coming out after the application, and that actually didn't happen. But then I noted that the period of application was changed to the end of December. And so I'm trying to understand, if you give notice of application of herbicides and the window is that large, it could take any place between June and December, I'm struggling to understand what the point of a notice is at all. That's just like saying we're going to spray sometime, isn't it?
Well, not exactly. Obviously, you know, they do, you know, as required by law, they do let us, you know, file a notification of application, you know, to let folks know this, you know, there's a minimum of a 15-day waiting period for then. And then if there's a written plan associated with that for any sensitive species, there's also a 14-day waiting period along with that as well. So that allows us to, you know, get that information out to any subscribers and let them know. And then a lot of it is, you know, they want to make sure that when they do apply the application of herbicide, that it's under ideal conditions. So it really minimizes any potential for any drift or anything like that. So they let us know. The law does allow them to extend that out until December 31st. And then, you know, we do everything that we can to, you know, follow and make sure that they, you know, are following all the rules of the Forest Practices Act.
Is there any kind of public notice that takes place at that time if somebody's wandering around with their dogs or bird watching or something like that, so they'd have some clue to stay out of that area?
There's nothing from the Department of Forestry. If you become a subscriber and in that area where they have notified, we do let you know, but there's nothing from the Department of Forestry that we put out to let folks know when that would happen. I mean, that would be something that would be up to the landowners to do, and usually they're very good about that stuff. They want, you know, they want people to know, they want to, you know, keep people informed, but it is something that would be up to them.
So if you're a person who tends to recreate in the forest and you're familiar with your area, you ought to know who the landowners are and kind of keep up a communication with them so you understand when these things are happening, I suppose. Most of us wouldn't want to get sprayed.
Oh, absolutely. I can completely understand that. But yeah, if you are recreating on the forest, it is your responsibility to know where you are, whether you are on private land or whether you are on public land. And again, if you are on private land, make sure that you, one, have permission to be there. And just, you know, I would encourage communication with that landowner, and I'm sure they would be more than willing to let you know about potential operations via, you know, harvesting, aerial sprayer, or road building, or any type of operations. I'm sure they would let folks know.
Well, whether it's private or state land, it's not ODF that's doing the spraying. There are people hired to do the spraying. Who hires them and who regulates them?
Well, the landowner would generally be the one that would hire the applicator. And they would, through that notification of operation, it's a notice, it's not a permit, but they notify the Department of Forestry and that they're doing a chemical application, and they would name the applicator, and there'd be the landowner be named there. They would describe what they're going to spray, where they're going to spray it, and give us a range of dates of when they would be spraying at. And that would be the notice that we would receive. We would review for any kind of resources that would be out there, fish streams or domestic streams, wetlands or so forth, that would possibly need a written plan. Mm-hmm. And if a written plan is required, then the landowner or the operator would submit in more detail what they're doing and where they're doing it, and we would review that. And that's once that's received by the Department of Forestry, then the public can make comments on that written plan. Mm-hmm. And there's a 14-day window to do that. And then those comments would be shared with the notification parties, the landowner, the operator. The department would take a opportunity to make comments after that 14-day period, and then those would be available for those who had made comments to review. And what's something that's exciting that the department is developing right now is a subscriber service through our electronic notification system. It's an electronic notification system. We've moved from a paper system to electronic, and we're in about the 10th month of doing that, and we're adding a module for subscribers where they become a registered user, they can identify their area of interest that they want to be notified when there's a notification.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a written plan with that notification, they would be pinged or an email would be sent to them telling them that the 14-day waiting period has started. They can comment, and they would be able to read other subscriber comments, and then it's going to really make it easier for everybody to see notifications and comments, and we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be something that would make it easier for an interested person to be informed about what's going on.
Right.
What about, Dan, what about the state forests? Now, when a clear cut happens on state forest land, who hires the
similar to what Keith mentioned, is it depends on what was harvested, what are potentially the competing vegetation types. We do aerial application of herbicides on state forests, but not on every clear cut and not on every acre.
But is that the ODFs? Do you do the hire on
or is we actually contract that out to licensed commercial herbicide applicators, which are licensed through the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Yeah.
That's obviously part of the requirements of the contracts that they have they follow all the valid laws.
Is that a business that where there are, like in Oregon, there may be only a few people who do that and everybody knows them, or is it something that lots of different people do?
With any specialized field, I'd say, that there's competition, but there's not, hundreds and hundreds of those vendors out there at the statewide level. We devise our contracts in a way generally through what's called an RFP, which is a request for proposal, that we don't always necessarily award it to the lowest bidder, but they meet a certain skill set and have a proven track record of doing good work.
And they are somehow regulated by the state or licensed by the state, so...
Yeah, the Department of Agriculture, I don't know if you want to add something to that.
Right. The principal agency in Oregon that regulates... herbicide applications is the Oregon Department of Agriculture. So they have a licensing requirement for applicators and then a continuing education that goes on year after year. And then they administer the application to make sure people are following the pesticide label. So mm-hmm. they do investigation and enforcement.
Well, I'm asking a lot about this in part because, as I'm sure you're aware, there's an organization in Eugene called Beyond Toxics. And they bring speakers around the state, and they've often talked about something that happened in Gold Beach that was mm-hmm. not a good thing with people being sprayed and so on.
Everyone can agree to that.
And but, so I'm just wondering what kind of what kind of structure we have in the state to sort of monitor. Is there anybody who follows up and makes sure that things have been done properly and makes sure that there hasn't been drift into streams and so on? How do we do that?
Well, the Department of Forestry, if we're notified of a complaint or a suspicion of something that's in violation of the pesticide label or in violation of the Forest Practices Act, we would investigate that. Once we're aware of anything that's related to a herbicide application that maybe went sideways, we inform the Pesticide Analytical Response Center, and that's a multi-agency group that responds to pesticide incidents that deal with human health and in the environment. So Oregon Department of Agriculture is part of that. The Oregon Poison Center, the Department of Environmental Quality, State Fire Marshal, we're on that as well as, let's see what else, there's Oregon Safety Health Administration, Oregon Health Authority as well. So it's a multi-agency entity that does the investigation and talks with each other and makes sure that the appropriate enforcement is taken if that's necessary.
Yeah.
I'd also like to mention too, Roger, that a lot of times we will have a stewardship forester, on site witnessing the application as well, just to ensure that things are going in compliance as well.
Good. So. That's encouraging to know mm-hmm. that your eyes are on that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, the reason I ask that is because just a couple of weeks ago, we had a fishing group here in town, and the fisher folks, we have two big longstanding industries here between forestry and fishing, and they have concerns about what's going on in the forest because they're seeing For example, one of the things they cited, and I think this actually came out of the Clatsop State Forest, on one of the streams in the Clatsop State Forest, between the fry and the smolt, you know, with salmon, the stages of life, they were counting, and they would go from like 200,000 fry to 2,000 smolt. There was a huge, huge die-off. And part of that seems to be because the water in the streams is getting warmer, because our climate is changing somewhat. But, you know, it's a fair question to ask, what about clear cuts? What about the removal of shade? What about the removal of down?
Well, that would be, that's the first I've heard of that, Roger. So it'd be interesting to find out where.
I will be, I'll get that from Bob Reese, is the one who has that. I think you may know Bob,
yes,
who
I
has
know
that
Bob.
Data, and get that from him for you. But it was kind of a surprise.
Well, it is, and it's part of it is to be able to factor in, be able to figure out what factors came into play.
What about the chemicals that are used in spraying? Who decides what can be used and what can't be used? Is that the Department of Agriculture is doing, or how does that work?
That's the Federal Environmental Protection Agency.
Okay.
All chemicals, all pesticides have to be registered, and they all require a label. And the label has specific requirements of where the chemical can be applied, when it can be applied, and how. And so that's really outside of the jurisdiction of the Department of Forestry.
How would a layman sort of learn more about that and try to reassure himself that what we're doing is okay? And you say this is an EPA thing, so it's a federal government controlled?
There's Oregon Health Authority, a state agency. They have the laws that govern drinking water. And so they really have that authority. We work with them, but we do something that I think your audience would like to be aware of. There is our updated private forest strategic monitoring plan is going before the Board of Forestry on November 2nd. And so that monitoring strategy is going to look at two different facets, how rules are being implemented and how effective are the rules. And they are, both of those are going to be looking at pesticides and how are the chemical rules being applied. Are they being applied, and are they effective at keeping chemicals out of the stream? So I encourage the public, if they want to share comments, that they could go to the Board of Forestry meeting or other public meetings and become informed and make comments.
Well, I do understand that anybody who works for the Department of Forestry is under pressure from a lot of different sides. You have the environmental side who doesn't want you to do things. You have the industry side that wants more access to the timber. You have the counties who want the money, and I know you guys don't set the policy. You try to implement it as best you can.
That is correct. And that's some of the challenges and some of the opportunities there of having, you know, defined statutes, policies, and rules, so we're making principle-based decisions. Sometimes they're not popular, but they're generally repeatable and defendable. And ultimately, if enough folks don't like, a certain aspect of it, it's time for them to have a conversation with their legislator.
So the place for the public to take its concerns would be either to the Oregon Board of Forestry meetings, mm-hmm. or to their own legislator.
Yeah, and as Keith said, I would encourage folks first to become informed. It's easy to get fired up about a singular issue,
mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times, like you said, it's a balance between providing for economic, environmental, and social benefits from the forest, particularly state forests. What is balance and what is sustainable? I mean, they're both very nice sounding words that are mean something different to different people.
Yeah, certainly does, and it's in the courts right now. So,
And then, like you said, we are faced with conversations from all aspects, including being sued for not providing enough revenue.
Yes.
We have to really stick to those principles and rules and laws and enforce those. And I wouldn't say stoically, but compassionately, but also following those rules. So if someone takes us to task, which they're like to do, we can honestly say this is what we did.
Neil, let me get back to you too. With the warmer weather we're having now, we had a pretty dry summer.
Mm-hmm.
What's that doing to being able to control fires and so on. What's that doing to the budget for that too?
Well, absolutely. No, we we do everything we can. We watch the indices. We watch the weather daily. Every morning I'm sitting on a conference call with NOAA. Get the updated forecast as well. We're prepared. We're constantly training our guys. We shipped a lot of folks off to other parts of the state to help out them as part of the complete and coordinated system there, to help out, Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon as needed there. So we've had, a bit of hot weather. We got a little shot of rain, this last week. However, we are going to get some Easter winds here coming up, Monday, Tuesday, as, folks may or may not be aware, East winds are, pretty, can really dry things out for us here on the coast range there. So that's kind of our point of concern. That's something that really perks our ears up. We're currently fully staffed. We're ready to go. And, just remind folks to be just very vigilant. Keep on task and be careful whenever you do burn. We do have a burn ban on currently in the county as well. So just encourage folks not to burn and we're ready for it.
And we have at least another month to go in the most dangerous part of the season.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. Just looking at the latest forecast, they're saying we're not really predicted to get much more precipitation the whole month of September. And this is typically when the coast range, is at its highest fire danger, is that, month of September into early October until we start getting those fall rains. So I just really encourage people to be fire safe when they're out there and we'll have folks and we'll respond and hopefully we won't have to.
Foresters really have to be like a diplomat now,
mm-hmm.
because you're pulled two different ways from the extremes. But what I say, there's value in that in the sense that the concerned citizens from both sides, regulations are too tight or not tight enough. Mm-hmm. They really do help us to keep evolving the Forest Practices Act to help Oregonians and help there be a future for growing trees, keeping working forests working, as well as protect the environments. It's really a Oregon effort, and it's challenging to be a forester, but it's rewarding.
Well, I'd also say anybody who has a chance to go on one of the forestry tours that you conduct maybe once a year is really an educational experience. I was really amazed by the giant Swedish machines that you had in the woods that were four guys were doing what would have taken 30 before, and that kind of speaks to also the loss of jobs in the woods. Well, thanks very much, you guys, for joining us on The Human Beat. We've been talking with Neil Bond, the Protection Unit Forester for the Astoria District of ODF, Dan Goody, who's the District Forester here, and Keith Baldwin, the ODF Forest Practices Act Field Support Coordinator.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
Thanks for listening to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rockham.